I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Franz Schubert's song of the lover is leafy and nostalgic. Linden Tree has nearly universal folk song standing by now. This is Matthias Gerne singing with the pianist Graham Johnson. Tree in German folklore was an idyllic trysting place near the traditional village green. In Schubert's song, it's a bittersweet memory as the singer here heads off on his winter journey. The cold wind blew straight into my face, he sings. My hat flew from my head. I did not turn back. We're talking this hour about the cycle of 24 Schubert songs known as Die Winterreise, or Winter Journey. They're the meditations of a man at the edge of madness and death. And over the better part of 200 years, they've been treasured among the deepest and darkest creations in music. Many musicians would say they're the best of the best. Connection listeners, we're getting the short songwriting course this hour about music that changed music. Our guests are Craig Smith, the pianist and conductor, and the tenor William Haidt, who will be performing Die Winterreise in Boston this weekend. They're also leading Schubert cultists in the circle of Emmanuel musicians in Boston who've been performing all the songs and all the chamber works of Franz Schubert over the last several years. And they'll keep it up until they're done. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Craig Smith, first of all, I'll exempt you, and you can exempt me from the sin of talking over this music, okay?
All right.
We just agree we're going to do it.
I'm not playing, it's fine.
Tell us about song cycles, first of all. Tell us about Schubert's time. Tell us about the world in which this music was created.
Well, I think the most important thing is to know that Schubert had written something like 600 songs before he wrote these songs, so that he was, let us say, experienced, and in fact had really almost sort of invented the art song. Certain earlier composers had done very distinguished, a few things, Beethoven and Mozart, for instance, but for all practical purposes, Schubert invented the idea of one singer and one pianist in a small room singing a poem and adding the element of music to a great poem. And I think that these pieces are definitely kind of the end of the line. Although he wrote some very great songs after this, there is a sense that this is the culmination of his songwriting career. And it certainly is, in a way, his deepest and saddest thoughts about his own life. Because his life was very... He had a very odd life. He had this close circle of friends, artists. I'm always reminded of the 50s of the Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac group. They were terribly sort of underground and not part of the establishment, which was rigid and worldly, sort of the way the 50s in America was. And these artists and poets and musicians kind of lived this underground hand-to-mouth existence, and he was clearly the most talented of the group, but they were extraordinary people, but they fought against the establishment just brutally, and they were politically very, very sort of leftist.
Go back to the song cycle itself. Did he invent that? This is a show, in effect, a narrative of 24 songs. They're not all exactly in the same spirit, but they are connected by the image that we take to be the image of Schubert facing death, too young. What is this cycle all about?
Well, Beethoven had written a song cycle, and a very wonderful one, Ande Ferne Geliebte, but it is really almost organized the way instrumental music is organized. I mean, it has an almost abstract organization. This work is a genuine sort of narrative. In fact, most people can identify 3 days and three nights in the piece. You really do have a sense that he is wandering through the snow. We have, in every song, a different kind of footstep figure. I mean, all of them kind of march along, except for the daydreams, which are sort of motionless. In fact, this song that we just heard is one of the daydreams. It's not that he sees the Lindenbaum. He is remembering the Lindenbaum.
We have throughout, as everybody always knows, a tremendous sense of motion to it. It never stops.
This motoric energy thing is very, very sort of unique to Schubert, and became an extremely important part of the 19th century. And he was one of the very first to exploit it. And it's obviously in here, it's all different kinds of footsteps.
We're talking about what many musicians regard as sort of the finest caviar in the whole catalog. This is Schubert's song cycle called Die Winterreise, The Winter Journey. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. There are many things to get at here. Among other things, Craig, I want you to talk about, you know, explain to the Martian who just landed what makes it great. But I'd also like to talk about the performance tradition here. Every performance of this thing is a great event. I'm reminded, actually, Isaac Stern was here a few months ago with a new book, and he was talking about, actually, the moments when they saved Carnegie Hall, one of his proud things. But there was a particular time when he thought he ought to gather, as he said, some of the musicians in the neighborhood, people like Jesse Norman and Leonard Bernstein and a few others. But he spoke of it as one of the pinnacle moments of his whole life in music, which has been all pinnacles. But sitting around a piano in an empty Carnegie Hall of a morning, after he'd rounded up his friends, and Fischer Dieskau was singing Die Winterreise with Leonard Bernstein at the piano, probably just groping sight reading from somebody's text. But he thought, and he's done it all, but that was as good as it gets in music. It's an experience that I'd like you both to kind of explain to Connection listeners this hour, why the best of the best think this is the best.
Well, I mean, I'm sure Bill will have different, it's a sort of different point of view from a singer than from a pianist. I think that it is the most sort of just nakedly intense music that I know. It also comes from a terribly deep place in Schubert's life. It was written in the last 6 months of his life. It's certainly the second half of the piece. Like so many great works of art, it started out something completely different than it ended. It started out as a short cycle of 11 songs, which are the first 11 songs, and it didn't have any of the kind of metaphysical implications that when he added the last half, it totally changed directions into something extraordinarily sort of metaphysical. I think that what it's about is that it is an amazing 24 shades of gray. I mean, the great thing about it is it has no contrast, or I mean, it has some contrast, but it really is intensely about one thing, which is the end of one's life journey, and about lost love and lost opportunities, about loss in general, and so that it can explore with an amazing detail these experiences. And it is, even though he was 31 when he wrote it, it is an old piece.
I want you to come back to this point about sort of the metaphysical edge. It does get you halfway out to eternity. I mean, it really, I think also of the posthumous Schubert Piano Sonata in B-flat, music that takes you as deep into the further spheres as...
All of the last Schubert, or much of the last Schubert does that, yes.
Can you put your finger on the moments where it does it, or the musical?
I think that there is one very specific issue with the text, and the text is also, I mean, is by a rather you know, sort of minor poet named Wilhelm Müller, but by the way he chooses it and the way he puts the text in order, this is the first, as far as I'm concerned, the first great work of Western art that is completely godless. There is no sense that anybody is watching the store. Mm-hmm. And even the one kind of religious spot is, which a song near the end called The Spirit's House, which is clearly a sort of a funeral chapel or something, is, I think, while it's laden with religiosity, is almost ironic and is certainly undercut by the rest of the cycle. I think that is a terribly important point that happened to Western, to Western culture, that it finally killed God.
William Hite, I want to hear the singer's perspective here. You're a tenor in what's often thought of as a baritone's song cycle here. How do you approach this mountaintop?
Well, how do I approach it? I approach it with a lot of respect. And what has helped me immensely in working this piece out vocally, since you asked, was the fact that we started working, I think, in August. And my own personal work, before I even met with Craig, probably started in June or July. That's the sort of that's the kind of preparation that is required for a piece not only of this difficulty and sort of renown, but also in terms of approaching it, because it is low for a tenor. There's a lot of low passages which require a certain working in of the muscles. There's no other way. You know, pianists and instrumentalists talk about muscle memory. It's the same for singers. There's no way to work it into your voice other than to practice it over a long period. And it does pay off eventually. There's a familiarity now with that part of my voice that I never had before I worked on this cycle.
Craig Smith is talking about sort of the Schubert authorship here, but there's also the great performance tradition around this piece. How do you deal with that? who's in the Winterreise pantheon as far as you go? And then how does a young singer like you approach them?
Yes. The interesting thing about it for me is that if you scour the recording catalogs for this piece, you'll probably find, I would say, maybe a half dozen tenors, maybe. And the only one that's really in great circulation is the performance of Peter Pears, which I think we've got as a possible...
I've heard about this with Benjamin Britten at the piano, and I've never heard it before this morning.
Well, you know, like I say, it's one of the few in the catalog. And so as a tenor, you don't have a whole lot of role models there. But for me, I think the D-scale performance with Gerald Moore, the second one, is one of the ones that I look for. I personally wish that Fritz Wunderlich had recorded the piece, that we could at least refer to that and know what that sounded like.
Craig, introduce one of the alternative...
We have another Lindenbaum performance by a very low bass and a very, very great artist, Hans Hotter, who was mainly known as a great Wagnerian bass, a famous Hans Sachs and Wotan, but was also a tremendous leader singer. And I think it's a down a fourth or something from even the baritone keys, and it's a completely different sound, but I think that he's one of the great leader singers. I think we should hear that now.
This is Hans Hotter and Gerald
and
Moore.
And also Gerald
piano.
Moore. Yes, right.
Ambrum et orem hora, dachte
heard Potter, he sounded even lower than this. But he's a real bass and a wonderful singer. You'll hear how much simpler his delivery is than Gerner and certainly than Fischer Dieskau. It was a completely different idea that the singer declaims the text as clearly as possible with a kind of minimum of editorial comment, but within just this perfect German and perfect singer line. It's a whole different way of singing Lieder, and I think a completely legitimate one.
Bill Hite, what are you hearing?
One is struck when you hear, for me, when I hear this transposition, when I hear the voice in the lower key, one is really struck by the different color. You know, the whole idea that certain keys convey certain emotions. And in fact, the piece, we are doing the piece in the keys that Schubert originally composed the piece. And that's not to be better than thou, but it does change it considerably when it's so much lower to me.
Right. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And some of the other darker songs are even lower than this in the Hutter.
And the voicing in the piano, I mean, some of these low notes may not even been possible on Schubert's piano.
Right, right. But I think that the important thing is the many different ways a singer and pianist can present this material, whether simply or with great sort of editorial comment. I would say that our performance is probably fancier than this in terms of what we do. I mean, certainly I would never in any way say better or even as good. But
I'm very eager to hear that Peter Pears and Benjamin Britten. Could we cue up another song?
Yes, Auf dem Flüsse.
Let's do it. And give us a little history here. People know Benjamin Britten as a composer, of course, but incomparable accompanist here.
Incomparable pianist as well as incomparable conductor also. I mean, his career as a performer is not... There's not so much documentation as a full-time performer, but what is there is extraordinary. Mozart and Schumann conducting, but also the great playing for Peter Pears. This song is this is a much more kind of typical song in Winterreise. This is Auf dem Flüsse, which is, again, you can hear the tramping of the feet in the piano part. It also has one of the just astounding moments in Schubert, which is when everything drops a half step from E minor to D sharp minor, and it really is like movement of tectonic plates or something. It's really as if the whole world cracks apart, and then it kind of claws its way back up to the tonic.
Will you just kick me to make sure I hear that?
Yes.
this song happens at a point at which we're well on the journey at this point, but I think this is probably one of the first songs where you begin to get a sense that the person on the journey is beginning to lose it a little bit, as it were. You know, he's becoming unhinged a little bit emotionally, not only emotionally, but just in general. It's the beginning of the descent into madness. He sees his heart reflected in the ice of the river, and he says, yes. Does your heart, do you also have that thick crust as well? Is it ever going to break? Is it possible? You know, he is closing up emotionally. He's just rounding himself off, and there's no way out, kind of.
And the other thing is that it's the irony of this rushing river frozen.
Yeah.
But cracks appearing, and that you can hear in the music, these cracks.
Let's listen. This is Auf dem Flüsse, on the stream, and it ends, as you say, Bill, with this reflection. He says, my heart, in this brook, do you recognize your own image? Is there under your surface, too, a surging torrent?
And what happens right at that spot is that you can hear the piano taking the tune, and the singer just kind of croaks out, mein Herr.
The singer is Peter Pears. Yeah. The pianist is Benjamin Britten.
Herr, du so lustig rochtest, du hell.
This after I haven't listened to this for years, how Britain is really leading the action here, that funny kind of nasal voice of Piers is really obviously declaiming it superbly, but not musically leading. I think that it does show how what a different color this piece has with the higher voice, that it's almost easier when you're a bass or a baritone to summon up the tragedy because it's just so low and murky. Whereas here, it's up to the singer and the pianist to do it with musical gesture rather than with the actual color of their instruments.
I agree with that 100%. It's a challenge to with the lighter, higher voice to find those dark spaces, but what's life without great challenges, and this is one of them, for sure.
This is the Peter Piers, Benjamin Britten recording of Am dem Flusse?
Auf dem Flusse.
In the Schubert song cycle, Die Winterreise. The phone's 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK. Jan is on the line.
Chris, hi, it's Jan Swofford. How are you doing?
Ah, the Jan Swofford. The Brahms biographer.
Mr. Brahms.
Hi, Craig, and I also have a few things to say about Schubert, as it turns out.
Oh, good.
What I wanted to mention and, you know, sort of throw into the discussion is when I was growing up as a kid, there was this idea that somehow Schubert had a mystical premonition of his death, but as I think you've made clear, it wasn't mystical at all. He knew he was dying. And his last music, especially the Winterreise and B-flat Sonata and the extraordinary C major quintet, have this extraordinary sense, I think, of music about music at times. It's as if music is a symbol of life itself. Music was life for Schubert. And he's looking back at music and life as if from the other side. He's like a man standing outside a party who loved parties, but he can't do parties anymore, and he's singing about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. I think also one has got to say those last 9 or 10 months of his life are as prolific almost as any composer who ever was. When you look at how many pieces, how many great masterpieces he wrote in those last few months.
You marvel that a human hand could move that fast.
Yes.
And it's also amazing how he responded to the prospect of his death. It's not exactly the kind of otherworldly sublimity of Beethoven. It's more, it's doom informed, but it's not really doomed haunted. It's a kind of transcendence that embraces death without sentimentalizing it. And the end of Winterreise, the organ grinder, I think is a classic case of that. I think the organ grinder is death in a way, and he ends the song by saying, "Can I go with you?" Mm. But it's not sentimental. It's weird and icy, and his last music is a transcendence of somebody totally involved with life, looking back on it with a kind, I don't know how to describe
it. No, you've done it brilliantly, Janet. We'll come to Die Lyrermann, the organ grinder, but I just want you to embellish that point. You're saying it's music about music. Craig Smith says it's music that changed music. What do you mean?
Well, for example, the B-flat piano sonata maybe is an example. It begins with this just heart-meltingly beautiful Schubertian tune, and then there's this sudden stop at a low trill, ominous trill in the bass, and then he just goes right on to another incredibly beautiful tune. So he's developing the way music is put together, and that low trill informs the whole piece, and that's the sense of doom.
And also undercut.
That's another whole hour on the connections one of these days. Jan Swarford, I'm very glad you called and mentioned it. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the Graduate School of International Economics and Finance at Brandeis, offering an information session on all programs on February 3rd, 800-878-8866, and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Schubert Song Cycle Connection. Singing Frühlingstraum, A Dream of Springtime, from the Schubert song cycle Die Winterreise. We're talking about one of the pinnacles of European music with the conductor and pianist Craig Smith and the tenor William Haidt, who will be performing Die Winterreise this coming weekend. Talk a little bit about this song and this singer, Craig Smith, if you will.
Well, this is, I think most people of my generation, this is what we grew up as thinking leader singing was, and it certainly still is. He was the most prominent leader singer of the 50s and 60s and 70s, and it's incredibly detailed and heavily colored and inflected and very, very beautiful singing. This song has three different levels in it. One is a pure daydream. One is the horrible reality of what is happening right now. And then the third section is a kind of melancholy musing on what the contrast of those two moods is. It's a very psychologically complex piece.
William Haidt, what does a 21st century tenor hear in the Fischer Dieskau?
What I hear is this is not in the key that we do this piece in. We do it in a higher key. But yet, he manages to get a lightness of color that's so fantastic. And so, as I mentioned earlier about how keys make a difference, and sometimes the lower keys tend to deaden it for me, but this is a brilliant sound. He's like the one that we all aspire to. He's just a genius.
I think that it's unusual about Fischer Dieskau as someone who probably made more records than any other musician ever. I mean, I think that's safe to say that he didn't record well. Every time I heard him, and I heard him a lot, was more impressive than any of the recordings. But because I think that he was so gearing his performance to large halls that they often sound exaggerated on recordings, and they were not in the halls, because he would play in big places like Symphony Hall and Carnegie Hall.
1-800-423-8255 for the Schubert Die Winterreise connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Jackie.
To me, the greatest interpreter of music today since Horowitz died, the greatest interpreter of any music, is Dietrich Fischer Dieskau. I heard him sing, your guest there would be pleased to know, in a live hall, but that was doing the Schöne Müllerin, the Miller's Daughter, in Chicago, and it was a very great hall. It was totally full, and it was so still, you could almost see tears on people's faces. They were just still to silence in awe, because he was so moving. I don't find that the music of Schubert here is written for music, as someone said. It's music of such intimacy, such introspective feelings and responses and reflections, and that's what Dietrich Fischer can bring out so beautifully. His voice is not as deep as the one you had on earlier, Hans Hotter. It's not as big a voice, but it's those fine little thoughts and feelings that we all have at certain times, most of us, that he can express so well. And I think probably the other composers that come close to these cycles, the only ones maybe are Mahler in Songs of the Wayfarer, that also Dietrich Fischer Dieskau did so beautifully. That's where I was introduced to him on a recording. And the Schumann, Dichter Liebe, those are also wonderful songs to have on sometime. And I heard Lottie Lehmann, not at her best, was her late in her life, but she sang those with such, again, such expression. And that's what Schubert allows a fine interpreter to do.
You sound like a real fan, Jackie. How did you come to Schubert yourself?
Well, I was a singing student at Juilliard many years ago.
Ah, okay.
And I reviewed music for many years. But I love these song cycles. They are distinctive.
I think that...
Craig Smith.
But I think that your comment that it... I don't think that the two are at odds, that it is about very deep feelings about text and stuff, and Jan Swafford's comment about music as music. I think they, in fact, can live together very, very well, those two concepts, because Schubert is using the most advanced musical techniques to be extremely specific about emotional occurrence and emotional little explosions in one's life. I think that they live together very well, those two ideas.
Jackie, thank you. Are we talking enough, Craig, about the piano side of these songs? You've got a keyboard at your fingertips. Don't hesitate to demonstrate what you like.
Well, I think, you know, I can almost not separate out the voice and the piano, because, I mean, the pianist must know every word, and really the singer must know every little thing that happens in the piano part. I think that they're almost inseparable. Obviously, the piano sets up the rhythm of the tramping rhythm or the walking rhythm or whatever it is, and that the voice, and also sets up the harmonic motion, and that the voice lies on top of that, adding sort of specific verbal thises and thats, as well as melodies. Although it's very interesting how the piano really has the tune as much as the voice has the tune.
I think it's fascinating in this piece too. Craig was talking about the rhythm, the motor of the piece, how the rhythm portrays the actual motion of walking. And the more I listen to it and the more I work with it, it seems to me like there are two characters, really. There is the character who is having this experience, the man who is going on this journey. But then there is the character of the rhythm. It's almost as if the rhythm takes on a character and takes on a life of its own and forces the traveler's hand almost. It's almost as if he can't resist the inevitability. The rhythm becomes the inevitability of the death.
It's Can that be illustrated at the piano?
Yes. I mean, I think more, I would like just to say one more comment, though. I think that, we are talking about Vienna 75 years before Freud, and I think that it's no accident that this piece happened in Vienna, because in a way, these motor rhythms are like the subconscious. There is a sense that the voice lies on top of a teeming subconscious of activity, and that this is not only the man walking, but it is his life walking out in front of him. And so that all of these walking motives, like, and I've got a little keyboard here, or the piece that we're about to hear, or all of these walking motives, each one of them has a different color, a different texture, a different weight, but sometimes snow is deep and sometimes it's not deep.
Are you tired? When you're walking, are you tired? Are you angry? Are you,
right, exactly.
You know, it's
But it's not only the man or woman walking. It is also the steps of life. And I think that psychological component, which, of course, in Schubert's day, they would not have been comfortable or even know what we're talking about using psychological jargon. It is clearly there, that mindset is already there.
Connection listeners, we're celebrating Franz Schubert, anticipating Freud by 75 years in the song cycle Die Winterreise, which our guests Craig Smith and William Hite will be performing on Sunday in Boston. 1-800-423-8255. Joan is on the line.
Hi. My comment is, I guess, rather personal. My mother was a concert pianist, and I grew up with an enormous scorn for music, and I was very proud of falling asleep at concerts where Heifetz was playing, or Menuhin, or Marian Anderson singing. And I awoke really to music when I heard my first song cycle, and it was Brahms, and the song that struck me the most was that of someone lying in bed and on a deathbed, waiting for someone to come. And you're not sure if the person who is coming really cares or not. But the dying person says, oh, please, come. Come soon.
Yes, the Immer Leise wird mein Schlummer, I probably.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
it.
Right, yeah.
And from then on, of course, I went on to Schumann and, of course, to Schubert. And as a singing student, I sang an enormous amount of Schubert and love it more and more and more. And I think what's so important, if I didn't say it already, was the rawness, the absolute no barrier between the composer and the listener. It's so direct.
Well, I totally agree, and I also agree that one always has one, there's one door into this stuff. Everyone has in their past a song that simply sort of changed their life. I think that I completely agree that rawness and that directness, that is, in fact, what this cycle offers, just an amazingly modern way of looking genuinely at the rawness and the difficulty of life.
We could play all of these songs. Would you introduce
Wegweiser? Yeah.
Der Wegweiser. Yeah. Yeah, please.
This is another tramping song. It also is a song nearish the end of the cycle, so that the inevitability is even stronger here. I think we should listen to this whole thing, which is because the end is this extraordinary. You'll hear the sort of raindrop prelude of this. going on, which can not only mean the footsteps, but it could be teardrops, and it could be the water clock of life also. So
Der Wegweiser is the signpost. Let's
exactly.
This section of the piece, he is saying, what have I done in my life that I should shun other people on this journey? And as Craig said earlier, it's maybe the first godless piece of art. It is certainly empty of living things, with the exception of the crow in one of the songs.
And the extraordinary thing we should listen for is the end of the song with this sort of raindrop prelude. That same repeated note that you hear becomes just manically present and running our lives. Notice how also Schubert is, by this time in his career, profoundly contrapuntal, that the whole cycle is full of counterpoints, of canons, of little things going against each other, which again add to that sort of psychologically complex quality of his.
This is a section that Craig was referring to earlier. He is about to say, I see, I'll let this finish. He's about to say, I see a street in front of me. It's the street that I must take, and it's the street from which no one ever returns.
Notes are just like nails stabbing in your heart, and it's, I must say, psychologically difficult to play this song.
Matthias Gerner, the Fischer Dieskau protege, I guess, right?
Yes.
Baritone,
and a
German
brilliant band. Leader singer.
Playing with the American Graham Johnson at piano.
Englishman.
I beg your pardon.
Very Englishman.
Let's go for one more call. Stephen is on the line. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Bill, Craig, this is Stephen Carradianis.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Nice to see you. Quick
Hello,
question,
Steve.
I know it's the end of the hour. Where Schubert and indeed Brahms were always looking back over their symphonic shoulders at Beethoven, did Schubert feel the same intimidation composing leader in chamber music?
He didn't seem to at all. I think chamber music definitely he did. Certainly the quartets have this Beethoven. But I think that he realized from a very young age, as like an 18-year-old, he was doing things in song that had never been done before. And it was interesting. I was just reading on his deathbed, he was having discussions not about music, but about literature.
Really?
Yeah.
Stephen, I just wonder if you're still there.
Yes, I am.
I mean, Schubert, between the songs, the chamber music, and the symphonic music, I mean, that's all the music we need. It's all the music.
It's also intertwined. And what? His entire life, he lived in that shadow of Beethoven and felt he couldn't really cut it. And I just find that it's so ironic that in Vienna, when you go to the burial place of both composers, that they're side by side.
I wanted to ask you what connections you make between the songs, the chamber music, and the great, is it C major symphony,
the
unfinished
major,
symphony?
Unfinished, yes.
Yeah.
I find that he keeps on making the look back to Beethoven and the symphonies where he's constantly exploring with the songs, and we're all richer for it, obviously.
I think also, though, that the forms of the poems were extremely complex, and he really did understand all of the Greek forms that Novalis and these people were using and Schiller, so that he really, that was something adding to the richness of his form.
Craig, I'd like you to introduce the famous song about the organ grinder, a kind of hurdy-gurdy man that the singer embraces.
Right. This is the desolate end of this piece, and one of the most extraordinary things in all of the song literature. Oh, it's already going.
Let's hear it. This is Matthias Gerner with Graham Johnson again. Take us into it.
Well, I think musicians all relate to this, that, you know, maybe they are going to spend the last 30 years of their lives grinding an organ with a monkey, hoping for a nickel. But it is also, you know, possibly the Grim Reaper with the scythe. It can be many, many things. But listen to the barrenness, the left hand playing those open fifths, and then the singer singing this kind of modal, mournful, kind of wailing tune on top of it.
We'll go out listening to it. Thank you, Craig Smith and William Haidt. Together they will be performing Die Winterreise in Boston Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock at the C. Walsh Theater behind the Massachusetts State House. Thanks to you both, and good luck. Break a leg. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, John Hoder, Michael Garth, Michael LeClaire, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Hutchins, Wheeler and Dittmar, counselors at law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients, and by Sunday River Ski Resort, featuring 8 interconnected mountains, 126 trails to explore, and an extensive snowmaking system, SundayRiver.com. PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston University, this